This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Does free college work? I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. First weekend in July. Here's what's coming up this hour. A city in Michigan has been paying tuition for local students, thanks to donors, for more than a dozen years. We'll examine the results in Kalamazoo. Also, what does it say about you as an employee or manager if you're checking emails and answering calls on vacation? Plus, on the personal finance front, getting maximum happiness from your hard-earned money as priorities change with age, and the startups using high-tech to create meatless burgers.
So for meat lovers who've maybe been interested in eating less meat, this is a great option for them, according to these companies. So Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat have made products that include burgers, but other kind of meat products that really imitate the sear of meat, the texture of meat, the burn quality of meat.
Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon on the threat to the veggie burger. She's here in about 20 minutes. Well, in 2005, caught in a spiral of urban decay and a falling population, a Michigan city embarked on a bold experiment to save itself. It would give local students free college tuition. The program, funded by anonymous donors who pay the bill each year, kicked off a free college movement that has gained traction across the U.S. Has it worked? Josh Mitchell, staff writer at the Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau, has been examining some data. Josh, give us takeaways.
There's this big question about who free college would help. What would happen if the country as a whole moved to free college? Well, we have some clues from this city in called Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's about 2 hours west of Detroit. They started having a free college program back in 2005, so it's been about 13 years now. And there has been some good things to come of that. One of the biggest changes that has occurred since the free college program went into effect there is people who were going to college all of a sudden started going to more prestigious colleges. So maybe if you would have gone to a community college before this program went into a place or to a regional college, you then all of a sudden started going to maybe the state flagship college. So that was one of the biggest effects. The other effect is there was a surge in college enrollment overall after the program went into effect. So, whereas before there was, less than 60% of students in Kalamazoo who were enrolling in college within 6 months of high school graduation, now it's about three quarters of students are going to college. So, one of the biggest effects is that people are just more likely to actually enroll in college if they are told that it will be free.
Wow. What about finishing or graduating?
Right, so that's one of the issues here that makes this picture a little bit mixed. There is evidence to suggest that if you compare apples to apples, the same type of students that were in Kalamazoo before the program and then the same type of students after the program went into effect, you did see this bump in college graduation rates. More students across the board were more likely to get a bachelor's degree or a college certificate after the program went into effect than before. Two issues, though. One issue is that the demographics of the city changed a little bit after the program went into effect. There was this big surge in people moving into Kalamazoo to take advantage of the program. So, the student population right now is a little different than the student population beforehand. And so if you just look at the raw numbers, there wasn't really a big increase in college graduation rates. Number two, even when you account for the changes in demographics, yes, there was a significant increase, but it was a modest one. And so, I think one of the big takeaways of this story is that free college will do some good things, but it won't do it. It's not a panacea. College graduation rates overall are still pretty low. I think the six-year graduation rate or bachelor's degree attainment rate is about a third of students who graduate end up getting a bachelor's within 6 years. And so that's pretty low in the grand scheme of things. And so it raises this issue of, okay, if free college isn't going to, you know, solve all these problems that a city like Kalamazoo wants to solve, what will? Someone there compared this like an onion. You know, you take off one layer of the onion, which is the cost of college, and then you realize there are these other layers to the onion that you have to figure out before you can get to the core.
Yeah, I thought his analysis was good with that. We're speaking with Josh Mitchell, Wall Street Journal staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau. He's done a deep dive entitled, Does Free College Work? Kalamazoo offers some answers. Do they plan to make any adjustments going forward with some of this data that they've now collected?
Yeah, it's interesting. So one of the things that they actually did this past year was they changed the marketing of the program. So, you know, there's been this big emphasis in the K-12 school district there immediately when the program started, which was, you know, you could go to college, you could become college ready. You know, this district, there's a lot of minorities in the district. I think white students are about a third to 40% of the students. So most students there are either black or Hispanic. There's a small Asian population. And a lot of them are first-generation students. And so the message to them up to this point has been, go to college, go to college. And there was kind of this idea that, you know, you should try and go for a four-year degree. Well, now what's happened is they've actually changed the marketing, and they're saying, oh, by the way, you don't have to get a four-year degree. You can actually get you can go to a trade school, and you can get an associate's degree. You can learn a trade. You can go into, you know, some type of, like, skilled blue-collar work. And the main reason why they've changed the marketing is because they are trying to, you know, match people up with what they're most likely to succeed in. I think they've come to terms with the fact that, you know, some students might not be ready or might not even want to go to the traditional 4 year route.
Yeah.
And so if they're going down that route and they end up dropping out, well, hey, let's try something else.
Thanks, Josh. Josh Mitchell, Wall Street Journal reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Glad you could spend some time with us. It's vacation season, but in this always-on workplace culture, most people will be answering emails from the beach. In fact, a study by LinkedIn found that nearly 70% of employees work while on vacation. Doesn't sound like much of a vacation. How can we truly break free from the office? Guidance from Dr. Ivan Meisner, workplace expert and co-author of a new book called Who's in Your Room? The Secret to Creating Your Best Life. Ivan, how do you see this?
So I really think it's very much a North American problem, because if you go to Europe, they have no problem taking summer vacation. Maybe a little too much, but I think there's something in between what we do in North America and what they do in Europe.
And why is that?
Well, I think in Europe, the summer vacation and the vacation time is really inculcated into the culture, whereas here in America, it's no, you got to be working all the time. You got to work while you're on vacation. And that is just, it's a bad idea, because I believe that if you want to have a life of what most people call balance, I call it harmony, you have to have margins. You have to be margins around your life. Times for you to relax and to recharge your batteries. And if you don't have that, you're not going to be your best. I mean, I hear people who say, oh, I haven't had a vacation in, you know, 5 years. You're an idiot. You haven't taken a vacation in 5 years. I'm not impressed.
Right. Also, I guess let's stop playing the game. Stop calling it a vacation.
Yeah, no kidding.
Then just keep working.
No kidding. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the latest book, Who's in Your Room, is that you have to be present. So if you're on vacation with the family, be on vacation with the family. If you absolutely have to do an email, wait until, you know, they all go to bed and respond to some of the emails. But my advice is do an auto reply. I try to do a really fun auto reply. You know, I've been kidnapped by my family and taken to a remote island. And, you know, they won't let me, they're holding my device hostage. I'm not going to get back to you for a week. And people chuckle. They get it. It's okay to take time off.
What's the best way to identify somebody at the office who can really help?
So you want to find, ideally, if you have an assistant, that's what you want to do. But if not, you want to find a peer. And one of the best ways I'd recommend that you do it is, first of all, find someone you know, like, and trust, and someone who you're willing to do the same for them. As a matter of fact, I would go to them first, and I would say, hey, I'm going to take a week off. I'm really going to be disconnected. If it's a critical emergency, you know, call me on this number. But otherwise, would you mind responding to people for the normal business? And I'll do the same for you. And if you can do that when they're going on vacation, so you do it for them first, they're then happy to do it for you as well.
Speaking with Dr. Ivan Meisner, workplace expert, also co-author of a new book called Who's in Your Room? The Secret to Creating Your Best Life. And we're talking about the secrets to not working on your summer vacation. Do you get the sense that in North America we'll ever be able to break this?
I think so. I think millennials are probably getting it right, where they understand. They may be going, the pendulum might be going a little too far the other way, but but I think they're getting it right that it's okay to take time. It's okay to take vacation time. I know one thing, when I'm 70, I'm not going to look back and say, gee, I wish I spent more time working.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's worse for C-suite employees. You know, in the study that was done recently by LinkedIn, only 5% of C-suite employees said they stayed completely disconnected, even through email or phones. Only 5%.
Thanks, Ivan. Dr. Ivan Meisner, workplace expert. Again, his book is called Who's in Your Room? The Secret to Creating Your Best Life. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. For decades, veggie burgers showed up on menus and at barbecues as an alternative for those who say no to meat. Now, a couple of startups are adding to the mix their high-tech imitation meat. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Those meatless burgers are taking a bite out of the old-fashioned veggie burger. More from Heather Haddon of the Wall Street Journal. Heather, why is everyone so enamored with the burgers made by Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat?
So for meat lovers who've maybe been interested in eating less meat but just don't want to sacrifice the taste and the meat qualities they love, this is a great option for them, according to these companies. So Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat have made products that include burgers but other kind of meat products that really imitate the sear of meat, the texture of meat, the burn quality of meat when you cook it. And so they say they are a superior kind of vegetarian product to the more old school version of what we've had for many, many years, which is, you know, made out of soy or vegetables or mushrooms or beans, and really doesn't resemble anything that is like meat. Never really intended to, but now these companies who are making some of these more traditional meat products are trying to catch up.
Heather, what do people say who have tasted the meatless burgers as opposed to what a veggie burger tastes like?
Well, it really depends on who you talk to. So for meat eaters and meat lovers who, again, the companies say they're really geared towards people who like meat, they say this is a pretty good imitation of meat. It's, the texture is good. The flavor is not the same as meat, but it's similar. It can help give them a meat experience without having, you know, some of the maybe the health guilt or the environmental or animal guilt that comes with eating real meat. But some more pure vegetarians say, you know, it's almost too realistic. It just doesn't, they don't want that. They're fine with the old school veggie burgers. They don't necessarily need this.
We're speaking with Heather Haddon of the Wall Street Journal. What are traditional veggie burger makers saying about all this?
So they are doing a number of things. So some of the big companies in this space, Kellogg, which makes Morningstar and Garden Burger, Kraft Heinz, which makes Boga Burger, and there's some other players. A lot of them have been reformulating their products to include brands that are more meat-like, have a different texture. But, you know, interviewing folks from Kellogg's, they're saying, you know, we are the biggest brand. We have the most distribution and food service, and we're really not asking, we're really not having any of our customers ask us for something that is so lifelike that it bleeds. That's something that the Beyond Burgers claim to do through beet juice. You know, they're saying we offer a more versatile product. They also say that their supply chains are much more robust than these startups, which have had issues in fulfilling all the demand they've gotten.
This is all kind of about hamburger meat. Where are we on things like sausage that are plant-based?
So Impossible has also got on in that space, Little Caesars. They helped develop a product for Little Caesars that is sauce imitation sausage that they will they are starting to put on their pizzas. But again, these more old school veterans say, you know, we have a much broader range of products. We have sausage, we have imitation chicken, we have imitation seafood, we have chicken nuggets, we have all kinds of options out there that will help satisfy a broader range of meat replacement needs.
Is this perhaps a fad of some sort, or do people think this is really the beginning of a major change in the way we eat?
Well, that's what we really want to wonder now. So there has been a lot of hype around these products. It's got a lot of buzz and news, which has generated demand. It's also really pleased investors. And like you said, Beyond Meat's stock has really surged, but we're starting to experience a bit of a roller coaster. So we're really going to have to see. So the big fast food chains like Burger King, White Castle, others are rolling out these products. They believe that the demand is there for good. But, you know, some of this is certainly driven by curiosity. So we're going to have to see if they taste good enough and if people are willing to pay a bit more for them to make it stick.
Thanks, Heather. That is Heather Haddon at the Wall Street Journal with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your holiday weekend with us. Coming up this half hour, maximizing happiness based on dollars spent. Also, how Stranger Things whipped up 80s fever as season 3 gets underway. And the mom praising a passenger who looked out for her autistic son who was flying alone. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. As summer heats up, so does the risk of contracting foodborne illness. Poolside festivities can lead to food being left out in the sun too long, and grilling can get tricky without a thermometer. That means that summer barbecues can offer the ideal conditions for the bacteria that cause foodborne illness, which kills, believe this, 3,000 Americans each year. That's according to the CDC. We're joined now by the food police in the person of Adam Gehring, food safety expert at the USDA, who willingly takes our teasing. Adam, give us some guidance.
Yeah, so during summer, we've got a couple considerations that we need to take into account. And it mainly has to do with temperature, especially the temperature outside, but the temperature of our meats. So my two big items for everyone out there are time and temperature. So whenever you're cooking any meat and poultry, you want to make sure you get it cooked to a safe internal temperature. So a lot of people will use color or time as an indicator of doneness, but those are only really guides. The only definitive measure of doneness and safety is to use an internal temperature, so a food thermometer. So those are the big ones. So your whole cuts of red meat, your steaks, roasts, and chops are safe at 145 degrees with a 3-minute rest. All the ground meats, hamburgers, those sort of items are safe at 160 degrees. And then all poultry, whether it's ground or whole cuts, is safe at 165 degrees. Right. And then on the time side of that, especially during the summer, when it's above 90 degrees, bacteria grows very rapidly.
Mm.
So we always want to get all our leftover foods in the refrigerator or a cooler if we're out at a cookout within 2 hours. But really, during the summer, it's within 1 hour. So anytime it's above 90 degrees out, you want to get that food in the cooler within 1 hour. So those are the main takeaways for the summer.
All right. The temperatures that you referenced before achieve what for us?
Yeah, so those temperatures, once you reach those temperatures, they instantaneously will destroy any potential bacteria that can cause illness in there. So as soon as you get to that safe temperature, you've destroyed any bacteria. So it'll help prevent a lot of illnesses, and it's actually, some people might think that they don't get sick or don't get foodborne illness, or they've been doing it correctly for all this time, they've never got sick, but it's actually a very common issue within the United States, and 128,000 people are actually hospitalized each year from foodborne illness. So it is something that does occur, and it's something that we can prevent.
We're speaking with Adam Gehring, food safety expert at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So when you go to a cookout, do people fear you lingering around the grill going, oh man, it's Adam, man, he's going to be looking to see if I got a thermometer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you that guy?
It's a dilemma. Yeah, it's difficult, but it's something that I try to really focus on. I'm actually going to a 90th birthday party for my grandmother this weekend. So it's something where we're going to have a lot of at-risk individuals out there,
oh,
her
wow.
friends
yeah.
that are all above 65. So it's something where it might be awkward to bring up, but it's a good public health item. So think of yourself, if you're out at a cookout yourself, you're not just protecting yourself, you're protecting public health.
Thanks, Adam. Adam Gehring, food safety expert at the USDA. 22 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. As you get older, do you become ever more deliberate in how you spend your time and money? Maybe you're more conscious of how to get maximum happiness from the dollars you have. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements of HumbleDollar.com has been exploring these ideas. Jonathan, what did you come up with?
Gordon, I like to write about the topic of money and happiness. It's one of those topics that I find endlessly fascinating. And so one of the things that I did with this piece, which came out on Saturday, was to sit down and think about some of the lessons I've learned about money and happiness from recent years. And maybe one of the number one lessons I've learned is that you shouldn't just use money to try to buy happiness. You should also use money to try to avoid unhappiness. And the example I cite in this particular article was when it comes to cars. When I think back to my 20s, I owned a series of clunkers that invariably broke down, normally at the worst possible time. And having an unreliable car, as I discovered back then, was an enormous source of unhappiness. We hate uncertainty.
Right.
Today, I don't have a particularly flashy car. I have a 6-year-old Honda CR-V. But the one thing that I love about the CR-V is I know it's highly unlikely to be a source of unhappiness. It is incredibly reliable, and I know that when I start the 4 or 5 hour journey, I will actually make it to the end.
Right.
So the Honda CR-V may not be a source of happiness, but I know it's not going to be a source of unhappiness.
That's interesting. That's not lowering the bar of expectations, is it, later in life?
Well, I think actually expectations is an interesting topic. One of the things that I think we all like is the sense that we have a gradually rising standard of living. So, yeah, going from having unreliable cars in your 20s to having reliable cars in your 50s does feel extra special because you can remember the times when your cars weren't so reliable. You know, if daddy buys you a nice, brand new, reliable car when you get out of college and you never had to live with an unreliable car, you probably won't appreciate having reliable transportation as much as I do.
Yeah. What was the point you made about working to not working and that unhappiness?
In terms of working to not working. So, yeah, one of the things that I just mentioned there, it's not just about cars. You know, clearly if you go from a car that doesn't work to a car that works, that's going to improve your happiness or at least, you know, take away your unhappiness. But if you take it a step further, let's say you go from having a reliable car to having a luxury car, you know, we imagine that upgrade is going to be a source of extra happiness. But the reality is we tend to adapt to these improvements in our lives. So while going from the car that doesn't work to the car that works reliably is going to be a big improvement, going from the car that works reliably to the car that, you know, is considered a luxury car and is the envy of the neighbors, that probably isn't going to do very much for you because, as I said, we really adapt to these improvements in our lives.
I love that point about being able to share that with others. How about your point number four about bad news?
One of the things that they talk about a lot in the happiness literature, and I've mentioned again today, is this notion of adaptation. That, you know, when we have an improvement in our lives, we tend to adapt to it, and pretty soon, you know, the kitchen remodeling, the new car, whatever it is, goes from being a source of happiness to being ho-hum, you barely even notice it. But fortunately, this also works in reverse. If something bad happens to you, you tend to adapt to it. For instance, people who have disabilities, permanent disabilities, tend to adapt to those disabilities to the degree that maybe they weren't as happy as before the disability happened, but they're never quite as deeply depressed as they imagine in the days and weeks immediately after the disability occurs. But, and this is the really interesting point, while we adapt to disabilities that are permanent, if we have something that's just like a nagging injury, you know, we have knee problems, it never really goes away, but we still have hope that one day it'll get better, we don't really adapt to that because there's no certainty, there's no finality about it. So in many ways, you're better off having a permanent disability than you are just having a nagging injury.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. So to keep viewers immersed in their version of the 1980s, producers of the sci-fi horror series Stranger Things on Netflix built their biggest shrine to the decade yet, and that is a shopping mall. Season 3 began Thursday. Here's John Jurgensen, entertainment reporter for The Wall Street Journal. John, preview it.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the period details sort of permeate the thing from front to back, you know, from all the production details to the marketing that happens on the back end. And they've really made like kind of a science and an art and science out of nostalgia as we use it today. You know, we've had period stories forever, right? Stories that take us back to a different time. But this one's doing something on lots of different levels that I don't think we've really seen before, and it's really become successful for them as a result.
All right, so explain some of what we're going to see in season three here with regards to that.
Well, I think like the probably biggest symbol of what they do is the setting they built for this season, which is a shopping mall. They took part of a mall that's still open, but I think maybe struggling outside of Atlanta, and kind of created their own version of what a mall looked like in the early 80s or mid 80s, I guess. The new season set in 1985. So what you get is like a lot of bang for your buck, I guess, and I'm sure they spent a lot of bucks on creating this mall. But they've got all these stores that would have existed and populated these malls in 85, like The Gap and Orange Julius and Sam Goody and things like that. And then they've also created this kind of place where they can make references to all of the TV shows and movies of that time that sort of refracted life as we kind of remember it now. You know, movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Weird Science and Valley Girl. So they're not just kind of making it look like it did in the 80s, they're making it look like 80s movies made last long, if that makes sense. You know, it's like, it's a Stranger Things is not set in the 80s, it's set in a movie about the 80s in some ways.
Right, reading your story is like opening my yearbooks. Like I was, middle school graduate in 81, high school in 85, college in 89. What was the reference that somebody made to Stranger Things being sort of like, I think the phrase was, a pre-internet friendship?
Yeah, that's the creators of the show, these twin brothers named Matt and Ross Duffer. And they were born in 84, I believe. So, you know, their memories of that time all come through the films that were made during that time. So, you know, they were alive, but their memories of it are really kind of shaped by the movies and TV shows made during that moment. So it's kind of like, you know, taking this idyllic lifestyle that they probably, you know, that they say that they lived themselves. So they grew up in North Carolina, you know, doing the kind of things that kids did before they had the internet. So I think they're trying to capture their own sort of childhood life back then through this show. And I think that's one reason why even like, you know, a lot of young people still respond to the show. Yes, you have like a core group of young characters who are all in their, you know, early teens. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, kids watching the show respond to that. But they also seem to really respond to the fact that, you know, life seemed simpler than it was, than it does now. You know, no phones, no technology, kind of tethering you to your parents, to your obligations, kids sort of roaming free. So whether or not that was actually how a lot of kids lived back then, it's sort of the way people idealized that time. And I think that's why not just, you know, older viewers, but young viewers respond to it too.
Thanks, John. John Jurgensen, entertainment reporter for The Wall Street Journal. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could be with us. A woman in Las Vegas is heaping praise on a kind stranger who looked out for her autistic son during the boy's first flight on his own. Fox News says Alexa Bjornson had recently sent her son Landon to visit his father in Oregon. But since Landon was flying alone and also has high-functioning autism, she sent him along with a note to give to his seatmate on the airplane, explaining that Landon, quote, might be nervous and ask, "Are we there yet?" many times. As she explained in a Facebook post, Ms. Bjornson requested, "Please just make him feel safe and comfortable." Fortunately, Ms. Bjornson later received a sweet message from the man who ended up being Landon's seatmate. Ben Pedraza says the two had a good time and played a few rounds of rock, paper, scissors. He added, "He's a great kid, and you're a lucky mom." Mr. Pedraza later confirmed to KATU Television that despite making friends with Landon, the boy did have one request. After a while of cracking jokes, young Landon requested that Mr. Pedraza quit making dad jokes. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.